This is the news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, January 24th. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. We'll hear from CAI's Gilda Geist and Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. The second inauguration of President Donald Trump took place Monday, and he issued dozens of executive orders by the time the day was out. Here in our region, one order with major local implications was aimed at offshore wind. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
First, tell us what the executive order does specifically.
Well, the order puts what it says is a temporary pause, so with no end date, on federal permitting for any offshore wind farms. I'm sorry, for any wind farms at all, either onshore or offshore. It also pauses the leasing of new ocean areas for offshore wind. Trump said federal agencies should not issue permits or approvals for offshore wind until a review can be done of the federal practices around wind leasing and permitting. That review would be led by the Secretary of the Interior working with other agencies. One thing to note, though, is that it appears this order is not going to stop work on wind farms that already have all of their permits. It specifies that it does not affect developers' rights under the leases that already exist. So that is an area we're going to be watching. Many of the projects that have leases do not have all of their permits. So in effect, it does appear to stop some of those planned wind farms where they are, even if they are very far along in the approval process.
Which projects off the coast of Massachusetts are likely to be put on hold because of this?
Well, I will tell you what I know. It's been very difficult to get anyone from the wind companies to comment on this. But reading the language of the order, it seems likely that any project whose permitting is not officially classified as complete is going to be delayed. That means for us here in our region, Vineyard Wind 2 would be on hold. And then one that is very kind of murky is South Coast Wind. This South Coast Wind has been selected for a contract in Massachusetts, contract due to be signed soon. And the Biden administration has already issued a press release hailing the overall approval of South Coast Wind by the Department of the Interior. However, if you look at the more technical permitting dashboard for South Coast Wind, there are three items there, three smaller permits that are listed still as in process or not complete. I tried to get the developer to talk about that. They did not contradict that assessment, but they didn't really talk about it or acknowledge it either. This is South Coast Wind again. They sent a statement saying they're assessing the order and they're taking a long-term view. So South Coast Wind, slated for a Massachusetts contract, may have a hang up there. Again, the signing of those contracts was postponed until March. Mm-hmm. The other project that's slated to be signed for a Massachusetts contract, which is New England Wind 1, is already classified as fully permitted. So it appears that one would move forward.
You talked with a number of local folks who do have a stake in this wind issue to see what they thought of Trump's order. What kinds of responses did you hear?
I talked with both supporters and opponents. That is true. Mayor John Mitchell in New Bedford said that all along the city's support has really been driven by the desire to create jobs. And he feels those jobs are jeopardized by this situation. So there's some concern there. But he also kind of on the flip side said that a review of some of the wind lease areas he feels is warranted. And what is driving that is the concerns of commercial fishermen. Fishermen say that some of the wind areas, especially off New York and the Mid-Atlantic, would be difficult for commercial fishing. And that in particular is an area of interest to scallopers. I talked with Eric Hansen, who owns two scallop vessels in New Bedford. He said that he feels like now we finally have a presidential administration that's listening to those concerns. Although he is not completely opposed to offshore wind, he was glad to see this pause. And then on the pro wind side, I talked with Chris Powicki, who is an energy consultant on Cape Cod. He also chairs the Sierra Club's Cape and Islands group and sometimes speaks for them, although he was not really doing that on this wind order issue. But he called this a dark moment for renewable energy. He said it really puts a chill on things like the financing of projects because of all the uncertainty that.
Jeanette, we may have lost Jeanette off the line there. Okay, we'll work to get Jeanette Barnes back on the line so that we can continue talking about that and another story that she has for us about Nantucket, bringing some deed restrictions to year-round properties on the island. But right now, let's turn to CAI's Eve Zukov, and we'll pick up the offshore wind story right here. As President Trump signed the executive order slamming the brakes on offshore wind, he cited as one reason the impact it may have on marine life. If you're into whales, he said, you don't want windmills. And he was speaking about wind turbines, of course. Windmills are, in fact, something else. But is it true? CAI's Eve Zukov joins us now for some basic fact-checking. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
The president has repeatedly said that offshore wind is making whales crazy and batty. Scientists and researchers have, in fact, spent quite a lot of time studying whales and what happens around wind farms. Tell us, what do scientists have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, these claims, crazy and batty, there's no evidence of that at all. What we do know is that offshore wind farms produce underwater noise, and underwater noise can disrupt a whale's ability to navigate, communicate, and feed. But offshore wind activities introduce two specific sources of sound that have been pretty well studied. So first, they introduce high-resolution geophysical surveys, which are used to, like, test the seafloor ahead of construction. And second, they introduce pile driving to actually install a turbine's foundation. But the surveys, the first thing I mentioned here, are often completely outside the hearing range of whales. So federal officials with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management say there's no evidence that the surveys have or will harm marine mammals or sea turtles. And pile driving noise is in whales' hearing range, but developers are required to minimize it. So for example, developers use air bubbles around a construction site to absorb the sound, and they hire human observers, and they use cameras and deploy underwater microphones so that pile driving can be paused if a whale is seen too close. And they don't really get too close. Researchers from Duke University found that when fin whales are in an area with pile driving, they just kind of move further away from the sound. There are no dramatic or even subtle impacts on behavior to note.
We've talked about on this program how many whales have been washing up dead on our shores at the same time that offshore wind farms are being built. What about a connection there?
Yeah, this winter in particular, there was an unusually high number of dead whales found around Cape Cod in a very short period of time. It's not yet entirely clear why, but the National Marine Fisheries Service has said, quote, there are no known links between large whale deaths and ongoing offshore wind activities. And we do know what does kill whales, and this is true across species for decades. They get hit by boats, they get entangled in rope and fishing gear, and these issues are compounded by climate change, which forces whales to chase their food into new, usually cooler waters, where there aren't necessarily protections against entanglements and collisions. Mark Baumgartner, a marine ecologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, told me that those very issues have been dogging whales for a very long time, long before 2016, when Block Island Wind Farm began construction as the first offshore wind farm off the East Coast.
Let's look backwards. What happened before that? We still had dead animals on the beach. So we can imagine a world in which offshore wind construction is halted and we will still have dead animals. Only in addition to that, we will be worsening the climate crisis. We will not be replacing fossil fuel energy production with clean energy production.
So why have myths about offshore wind in Wales taken such a deep root across coastal communities and government and beyond? Why are we hearing so much about this?
Yeah, this is the question that keeps me up at night. And it's a complicated one because it taps into the psychology of human beings and the complexity of myths and disinformation campaigns. So at a high level, we can look at a paper from Brown University that linked 18 grassroots organizations that oppose offshore wind. They're linked through funding, membership, legal representation, and more to think tanks and conservative donors who are known to block climate policy in support of fossil fuel interests. Those groups and their members are incredibly active on social media, and when people see or hear that offshore wind is harming whales, and they care about whales, then they see a dead whale, they're beliefs devoid of expert input are formed and sometimes spread. And the beliefs are usually really well-meaning. I think that's what I've found a lot of the time, but it doesn't make them true. What is true, again, is that boat collisions, entanglements, and climate change have been shown to kill whales. And experts say misinformation about offshore wind is distracting from efforts to address those core issues. That's costing whales and the people who protect them.
That is CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's bring back CAI's Jeanette Barnes right now. Jeanette, do we have you?
We do, Steve.
Okay. I want to ask you about another story you reported this week. It's a policy story, very local to Nantucket. The town is getting ready to launch a deed restriction program to help support year-round housing on the island. Tell us about how this works.
Sure. This is a program in which homeowners or home buyers could apply to the town to receive a payment. It would be a percentage of the value of the house, and that would be in exchange for putting a permanent deed restriction on the house that requires year-round residency. The idea here, of course, is to help people afford year-round living on the island in order to keep a balance between year-round homes and seasonal homes. The Select Board Chair, Brooke Moore, told me they have already appropriated $2 million to spend on this pilot program, and it's almost ready to go. It probably will be starting in the first or second quarter as soon as they can devote enough staff time to the administration of it.
And the idea here is that if you're a homeowner, you wouldn't have to be selling your house to take advantage of this. You can be in your house. You're selling the year-round rights to the house that'll go accompany the deed. Is that right?
That's right. That's, you know, if you meet the program guidelines, Brooke Moore gave me the example of a senior citizen who is having trouble affording to stay in their home. Maybe their money is mostly tied up in the house. They could get cash for the deed restriction and use it to live on, and it would help them stay in the house. So that does seem like something that could generate a significant amount of interest.
As I understand it, Nantucket has tried to do this in the past, but this is the first time they've been able to do it.
Right. Nantucket has been trying to get the state's permission to do this by using a home rule petition. My understanding is that was necessary because this program uses taxpayer money for a payment that actually goes to a private homeowner. But now, under the Affordable Homes Act, which was signed last year, they don't have to do that. And that is because that law created the seasonal communities designation. Nantucket is designated a seasonal community. And that gives the towns certain rights and responsibilities, obligations that are all centered around trying to address the housing crisis. And so it allows them to do these deed restrictions.
You said the town is paying for the value of these deed restrictions as a percentage based on the value of the house, and they already have $2 million in a fund to start this. Explain where that money's coming from.
Well, yes. Voters on Nantucket have done a lot to support affordable housing. In this case, the money is coming from the town's Affordable Housing Trust, which is funded by town taxpayers. About 2 years ago, Nantucket voters approved a permanent tax override that puts $6.5 million a year into the trust. So now they have the money to do this and other housing initiatives on Nantucket.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you so much.
Thanks.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break right now. When we come back, we'll speak with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Living on an island comes with many unforeseen challenges. Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to talk about a very modern one. Hi, Unki.
Hello, Steve.
This has to do with car ownership, specifically electric car ownership. You start this with a story of vineyarder Catherine Wilson. Tell us what happened to her.
Sure. Catherine, in November, she hit a deer while driving her kids back from a birthday party. And she was trying to get that electric vehicle, a Volkswagen, off of the island because she was trying to get to an auto body shop that is used by the dealer she was leasing the car from. But when she got to board the ferry, she was told she couldn't get on because there was damage to the electric vehicle. And that's when she found out that there was a policy preventing damaged electric vehicles from riding the ferries, although the policy itself kind of is more specific towards the batteries.
Mm. So this is actually a Coast Guard policy, which is that damaged electric vehicles aren't supposed to ride on ferries. In this case, you have some pictures of the car here that hit, you know, that struck a deer. It has a dented fender panel, kind of the front left fender panel. But the concern here is not about the body, it's about the battery, right?
Yeah, so the policy that the Steamship Authority currently has, it stems from an advisory that the Coast Guard put out in 2023 following the aftermath of Hurricane Ian, because first responders were finding a bunch of these electric vehicles that were submerged in salt water. They were catching on fire. And investigations show that the salt water degraded the batteries, and that can lead to a thing called thermal runaway, which is when an electric vehicle battery short circuits and it starts heating up uncontrollably, which can lead to a fire. So the Coast Guard gave out a recommendation. If there's damage to the vehicle's battery, don't let it onto your ferries. But also, there's a part in the Steamship policy saying that external damage could lead to, like an accident or whatever, could also lead to damage to the battery.
Green energy advocates you spoke to, they said this is not ideal, obviously, but they weren't too alarmist, it sounds like. They kind of pointing to the fact that all of this is a work in progress.
Yeah, because electric vehicle adoption is still in the works, more or less. There are still chargers and whatnot trying to be built on the island. People are still weighing their options of when or if they want to transition to an electric vehicle. And the island has had other efforts as well to become more electrified, and alongside their goal of becoming powered by renewable energies by 2040.
I'm curious, so if a vehicle experiences some damage on the island, an electric vehicle, what is the protocol then for getting it repaired?
Well, if it's something like exterior damage, you could take it to an auto shop somewhere on the island, like Angel's Auto Body, which is where Catherine went, and that's where she found out other people have had serious similar experiences as her. But there have been some folks who have actually taken barges from the Tisbrook Transportation Company to take it over to New Bedford and then take it to the Alibi shop from there, which is something that even the Vineyard Transportation Authority, which is a bus service on the island, has done for one of their vehicles.
This does seem like one of those situations sort of crying out for an application of some common sense. Is there room for that? Can the Steamship Authority look at cars and say, well, this car is not going to burst into flames on the ferry ride across to the mainland? Or is this a hard and fast rule?
Well, whether they'll let you on or not is based on the discretion of the agents at the terminal and the captains. So there's a, I guess that's where the wiggle room might be, but steamship officials that we've talked to said this is mainly for the batteries and whatnot, but also whether there can be changes or not to said policy would pretty much depend on what the Coast Guard says, which we haven't really heard from.
There's a way in which one can imagine living on an island like Martha's Vineyard being ideal for electric cars because there's not a lot of the what they call that range anxiety. Most of your traveling is constrained that way. Does it feel that way, or is there issues like this really must sort of undermine that idea?
Well, who you ask will kind of change that mileage of sorts, but yeah, on the island, it is a pretty solid place to have an electric vehicle compared to the mainland, because there are several places where you can go get your vehicles charged for very low fee or for free. And, you know, the range over just on the entire island isn't that far. So it's a pretty good place, people think, to have an electric vehicle. But the ferry aspect does make some people hesitate, because while they do want to change to an electric vehicle, it's that thought of, what if I do get into an accident? What if I'm over at Market Basket in Sagamore and I get into a fender bender or something? Can I not go home in that case?
Mm. A lot to consider there. Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Unki, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's stay with the automotive theme. One town on the Cape is contemplating a town-wide speed limit. Imagine how fast you think that should be. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with this story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
The town is Chatham, and it has some unique circumstances that make this proposal a topic of consideration. Much of the town already falls under a single speed limit designation. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, we've all seen the signs along the street that say thickly settled. They're orange, yellowish-orange signs. Usually the speed limit is 30 miles per hour. Now, thickly settled zone is defined in state law, and it means a location along a street where buildings are spaced 200 feet apart or less for a distance of at least a quarter of a mile. And if you're familiar with Chatham, Chatham's pretty densely developed, and there's basically hardly any place in town that doesn't fall under this thickly settled designation. Now, the proposal that's come before the Board of Selectmen is to lower the thickly settled speed limit from the 30 miles per hour to 25 miles per hour. And state law allows this to happen, but it needs a vote of town meeting. So recently, the Board of Selectmen in town had this proposal come before them, and you know, they debated whether it's worthwhile to have a townwide 25-mile-an-hour speed limit.
And this would be for safety, for the feeling that there's more cars traveling more quickly now, or what's some of the impetus?
Basically, it's a safety issue, because you have these areas in Chatham, most of the town, where there's a lot of homes. Especially in the summer, there are a lot of pedestrians, there are a lot of kids, animals, dogs along the streets. So basically, they're looking at this as a safety measure to keep traffic under control and to prevent too much overly speeding in these areas. Now, there was some debate about whether it was worthwhile to do this in terms of, was it going to slow traffic down too much? Will people, conform to this? According to the deputy police chief in town, Lou Malzone, this would not apply to Route 28, which is a state road and actually has a higher speed limit, even though there are sections of 28 in town that would fall under the thickly settled definition, but because it's a state road, it isn't covered by that.
What was, can I ask you what the select board's response was as they took this up?
Yeah, there was some mixed feelings among the board members. Some of them felt that it might not make a difference in town. Others felt that it could help solve some of the issues in some sections of town where there tends to be speeding. There was a suggestion from one board member that the town identify those streets where this is an issue and just target them for the 25 mile an hour speed limit. But, Deputy Chief Melzone said, given the development in Chatham, it would almost be easier to identify the roads where the thickly settled definition wouldn't apply, because it would probably be just a few of the more rural roads in town. But in the end, the board voted to ask the town manager to draw up an article for the May town meeting to ask voters to reduce the thickly settled speed limit to 25 miles an hour. So basically they weighed in a little bit, but they decided that, you know, this is an issue that the townspeople need to weigh in on because they're the ones who are going to be affected by it.
Do you have a sense of, as it heads to town meeting, what the discussion is going to be like? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I don't know. We haven't heard too much feedback at this point yet. If we gauge the discussion at the Board of Selectmen, I think it's going to be a bit of a mix. Mm. And if I were to take an educated guess, I'd say that people in town may go for the option or of defining the roads where the 25 mile an hour speed limit would not be appropriate. Mm. And instead of designating basically the whole town as a 25-mile-an-hour zone.
That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, where you can read all about it. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
The Wellfleet House, known as the Blash House after its former owners, has been the subject of years of contention. It's a big house built in 2010, near enough to the edge of a bluff that it is now, following 15 years of erosion, just about falling over that edge. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain the latest development here. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
I'm going to cut to the chase here. The latest development is that the current owner is telling the town he's not going to do anything more to remove the house, and it sounds like he's kind of daring the town to let it topple into Cape Cod Bay.
Well, that's right, and it's a stunning development, which the Conservation Commission in Wellfleet discussed at their January 15th meeting, where they were expecting to receive from the current owner, John Bonomi of New York City, a plan for the demolition of the house, which is currently 5,153 square feet. Instead of getting the demolition plan, they got a letter from Bonomi's lawyer, Thomas Moore, saying basically that he was washing his hands of the whole deal and it was up to the town to deal with the house. The estimated cost of removing it is $1 million, says lawyer Thomas Moore.
The owner had wanted to shore up the bluff with some stone, riprap or whatever, but was not allowed to because that's against actually coastal zoning.
Exactly.
But it seems like being denied that, they're kind of saying, well, if you won't let me do this, then you figure this out. Is that?
Well, that's basically correct. So the former owners, Mark and Barbara Blash, had applied to the Conservation Commission back in 2018 to build a stone revetment 241 feet long to protect the house. And the Conservation Commission denied that request based on, just as you say, coastal erosion structure regulations that were put in place back in 1978. The Blashes appealed that decision in Superior Court. The Conservation Commission's denial was upheld. They appealed that decision to the state appeals court, and where it is still pending. But in the meantime, the embankment, of course, has continued to erode, and the house is really literally right on the edge. Bonomi had to spend apparently several hundred thousand dollars removing part of the house, a turret and a large deck that had become so unstable that they were about to fall into the bay.
You have some description of what would happen if the erosion continues and this starts tumbling over the bank there. It's got a potential to make a big mess.
It's alarming. John Cumbler, who's a member of the Conservation Commission in Wellfleet, said that if the house falls into the bay, it really could be a catastrophe. He said, quote, the currents are going to pull that material and that waste around Jeremy Point and into the harbor. If that happens, there's a high possibility it can contaminate the oyster beds and threaten Wellfleet's oyster industry. And if you know this area of Wellfleet, it's a very conspicuous spot known as the Gut, a narrow strip of land that separates the bay from Wellfleet Harbor. And it's the entrance to Great Island, at the end of which is Jeremy Point. And coastal studies have shown that the currents there would pull the debris from such an event right around that point and right into Wellfleet Harbor. So the Conservation Commission and the whole Wellfleet shellfish community is really disturbed by this prospect.
What happens? What is the town's... it sounds like people in the town were quite taken aback, obviously, by this latest sort of turn by the owner, the current owner. What are their options that they're looking at? Do we have a sense?
Well, the immediate action was that the Conservation Commission issued an enforcement order requiring the property owner to put special conditions into effect at the property, including erosion monitoring reports to be submitted every 2 weeks, or alternatively, one day following any heavy weather, you know, with heavy rainfall or sustained winds of 40 miles an hour or more. But the owner has not done any of that. It's not clear what the town is going to do next. Town Administrator Tom Guarino told us that he, the select board, and the conservation department were going to be meeting with town council to figure out what to do next. But it's a pretty unclear situation right now.
Hmm. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. 6 months after the federal government shut down the offshore wind farm Vineyard Wind following a blade breaking on a turbine, that suspension order has been lifted. It came in the last days of the Biden administration, and it has some stipulations. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current has this story and more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
We know that Trump slammed the brakes on offshore wind with an executive order this week, but Vineyard Wind is in a unique position because it has all its operational permits, but it still wasn't producing power as regulators examined what went wrong with that broken blade. Tell us about this lifting of the suspension and the conditions that go along with it.
Yeah, as you said, this was one of the final actions of the Biden administration in offshore wind before the Trump administration took over. And as you said, Vineyard Wind is obviously in a different position than some of the other ones that may have received permits or leases. This is under construction. All of the monopiles are in. But as we know, the Vineyard Wind has been under a suspension order from the federal government since July when the blade failure occurred and all of the debris came ashore on Nantucket. And this suspension order was modified several times over the last 6 months to allow Vineyard Wind to conduct some construction activity, including the installation of towers, nacelles, and the rest of the monopile foundations. But the blades were another issue. And this is something that the federal agency, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, was looking at closely. And in lifting the suspension order earlier this month, it was a really sweeping and interesting, the conditions that were put on it, and an acknowledgement that all of the blades that were put up, close to 66 blades on every single turbine, are going to need to be removed. And this is a result of the discovery of the so-called manufacturing deviation that led to the blade failure in July. And seems to be an acknowledgement that this problem they found with insufficient bonding that was traced back to GE Vernova's factory in Gaspé, Canada, did not just affect one or two or three, but in fact, all of the blades that were manufactured at that plant are going to need to be taken down. So this is a huge setback and acknowledgement for Vineyard Wind that every blade that was put up is coming down, and that they will not allow Vineyard Wind and GE Vernova to install any blades that were manufactured in Canada.
Mm. Not a lot coming out of Vineyard Wind on this in terms of fresh information. Is that right?
No. And in lifting the suspension order, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOEM, and BESI did release an addendum to Vineyard Wind's construction and operations plan, which outlined all of the conditions that allowed the suspension order to be lifted. So not a lot of comments in terms of the timetable for doing all of this work, which is a significant amount for Vineyard Wind to take down all those blades and replace all of them, other than this work is going to be happening during 2025. So we're going to have to keep an eye on this and see how they maneuver and do this removal and reinstallation over the next year.
Jason, you have another story in the paper. The island has a new radio station, El Pingüino, and it's supplying a different kind of mix of music. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this was launched by the Nantucket Multicultural Media, which runs the other radio stations on Nantucket, including the True Island Radio, which is 97.7, the Quahog Country, 89.5, and announced this week the launching of El Pingüino, 88.1 FM, which is going to play Latin music, including pop, salsa, merengue, reggaeton, and is, you know, in launching this, Laura Burnett, who's the president of the radio group, said it's really an acknowledgement of Nantucket's diversity. And, our public schools are majority-minority. Half of our students are multilingual. We have a large Hispanic population. So this was launched in reflection of that reality on Nantucket. And it was done in sort of coordination and partnership with the Community Foundation for Nantucket.
El Pingüino takes to the air. That's pretty cool. Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
The Cape Wildlife Center was among the organizations that responded to a suspected avian flu outbreak in Plymouth over the weekend. CAI's Gilda Geist covered the story. I spoke with her earlier. Here's our conversation. Hi, Gilda.
Hey, Steve.
What do we know about what happened last weekend? It sounds like quite a number of birds were involved.
Yeah, so this was over the long weekend, and it was at Billington Sea, which is a pond in Plymouth. And so I talked to Dr. Priya Patel, who's the medical director for New England Wildlife Centers, and that organization includes the Cape Wildlife Center, which sent staff to the scene when reports started coming in that there were all these dead birds. And so before Dr. Patel got out there, Cape Wildlife Center's executive director, Zach Mertz, went just to check out the scene. He saw more than 60 dead birds, including Canada geese, swans, and ducks, plus more that were alive but clearly very sick. And the problem was that the pond was frozen over, so a lot of the birds were out on the ice, not easily reachable. So Cape Wildlife staff started making calls, coordinating with all these different town and state wildlife officials to make sure the situation was taken care of.
60 dead birds. Talk a little bit about what Dr. Patel told you about how wildlife officials responded to this scene.
Yeah, so the State Department of Environmental Protection sent a waste disposal company to collect the dead bodies. Mass Wildlife was also on the scene. They were able to give Dr. Patel permission to humanely euthanize some of the birds on site. Dr. Patel explained that the sick birds were showing symptoms that indicated that they were essentially too far gone to save. She said some of them were seizing, they were circling, and that tells experts that the most humane thing to do at that point is to euthanize. So because Dr. Patel is a licensed veterinarian and she had that permission from Mass Wildlife, she was able to perform these euthanasias on site. And that was instead of transporting them to a facility to be euthanized, which Dr. Patel said can be stressful for the birds.
So we say this is a suspected avian flu outbreak. Why suspected? What does that mean in this case?
Yeah, so that was also part of the response, was testing. Cape Wildlife staff were taking samples from birds on site because even though experts do seem pretty confident that it was avian flu, you do still need to actually test. In the meantime, Dr. Patel reminded us how we can keep ourselves and our pets safe, especially since we're seeing these avian flu outbreaks pop up all over the country. It's important to know that it is very rare for humans to get avian flu, but it's not impossible. You'll notice in some of the pictures on our website, CapeAndIslands.org, that Cape Wildlife staff were wearing personal protective equipment, and that's because it is not safe to get near or handle these birds without proper protection. Dr. Patel said that if you see a dead bird or a bird that looks sick, you should not get too close, you should absolutely not handle the bird. Instead, you should just report it to Mass Wildlife, as they're tracking the avian flu spread in the state, and there's a link to the page where you can make these reports on our website. And then you can also alert your local animal control.
CapeAndIslands.org, right?
CapeAndIslands.org.
Let's stay with animal stories, but one that is decidedly more upbeat. You spoke with someone recently from Mass Wildlife, which is a state agency, about a kind of elusive animal that nonetheless lives here on Cape Cod. Introduce us to the fisher.
Yeah, so the fisher is, in my opinion, an absolutely adorable critter. And that's where we leave my opinion. Now, we're just facts. He lives in the forests of Massachusetts. It's a mustelid, which means it's a type of weasel. So it's in the same family as, like, otters and minks. It's about 2 or 3 feet long with a big, heavy tail. And it has these semi-retractable claws because it likes to climb and hang out in trees. And, yeah, the fisher is pretty elusive, which is why I wanted to do this story. They're really quiet and really like to avoid humans, so we very rarely ever see them. And as a result, I feel like we don't know as much about them as other animals that we do encounter regularly, like deer or squirrels. Even the Mass Wildlife biologist I talked to for this story, Megan Crawford, has only ever seen a fisher in real life once. But chances are, if you're in a forest in Massachusetts, especially a coniferous one, you are in the company of fishers.
People who have never seen a fisher may nonetheless have heard the story that it makes a loud scream at night, but it turns out this is not really true, right?
Yes, this is a very common misconception. People who think they've heard fishers scream probably actually just heard a red fox scream, and that's because fishers don't really make much noise. Megan told me that if a fisher makes any noise at all, it's just this little, like, chuckle or grunt, and it's only when it's really stressed out. Now, the red fox, on the other hand, is known to be very vocal, loves to scream, and so that's a much more likely source of any crazy, blood-curdling screams you may have heard coming from the woods.
If you've heard a red fox scream, you will not forget it. One last thing. No fishers on the islands, is that right?
Yep, that's correct. It's the only part of Massachusetts where the fisher can't be found, so if you're an islander hoping to spot a fisher anytime soon, you will have to take the ferry.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist. You won't see it on the ferry. You have to take the ferry to the mainland to see it.
Oh.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist, kind of a correspondent to the animal kingdom this week. Thank you, Gilda.
Thank you.
This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a few minutes now to unpack in a little more detail the big story this week for offshore wind, this industry taking shape off our coast. And that is what President Trump's executive order really says and how it might apply. Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light has reported on this and joins us. Hi, Anastasia.
Good morning, Steve.
Talk a little bit about the details of what this order says, what it applies to and what it doesn't. And there are quite a number of projects along the East Coast in all variations of development right now.
Yeah, so it pretty clearly establishes a pause on all leasing, which means BOEM, the lead regulator, is not going to be holding auctions anytime soon, which is when they hold for sale these large tracts of ocean for offshore wind developers to purchase and ultimately develop. So that's pretty much come to a standstill. But there's another piece of the order which opens the door for potential amendments to existing leases or even termination of leases. So that's for projects that are already underway that have been purchased by developers. And so it might not be an easy thing to do, but it definitely is a threat to the industry.
One of your sources here described two ways in which an executive order he thought could play out, and it could be a what he called a refocus or a retaliate approach. Explain the difference and what we can gather so far about how it's playing out.
Yeah, so a refocus would be what most people were expecting, right, that the Trump administration would shift towards oil and gas leasing. The opposite happened with Biden. He issued an executive order and pulled away from oil and gas leasing. So at minimum, this refocusing putting resources towards oil gas leasing was expected, but retaliating would go further, which is trying to, you know, claw back efforts and progress that's already been made. And so an example of retaliation would be, you know, trying to terminate leases and put a pause on projects that are underway, but, you know, still require some final federal approval so that they could start putting steel in the water.
A number of these projects are facing lawsuits from various groups kind of pushing back on them. And it's up to the federal government to defend the projects, right? But now the federal mm-hmm. government is kind of, it's changing its approach to all of this.
Yep. And so it's also common with a change in administration, they might issue a stay in proceedings, so pause proceedings, so that the new administration with any new guidance can sort of see how it wants to approach pending litigation. But yeah, there's a real concern that, you know, they might proactively now, you know, want to seek relief or, you know, agree with the people who filed these lawsuits, many of which are post-offshore wind development, and say, you know, hey, you're right, we need to reevaluate this permit. We need to take another look, which could delay projects further, which, you know, costs money and introduces uncertainty, which isn't a good thing for investors when this industry really needs investment and certainty to establish supply chains and, you know, get these projects going forward.
We know that the state has leaned heavily into offshore wind. It's a big part of the climate goals that the Commonwealth set. What is Governor Healey saying after this executive order?
Yeah, so it's no surprise that she's still very much in support of offshore wind and stresses the importance of it for not just Massachusetts, but red states and other states that, you know, are helping to build the supply chain, and it's creating jobs. And it's strong investment. New Bedford, it's drawn a lot of investment too. So, you know, she's still got her foot on the pedal, but she did acknowledge that, you know, that she is concerned about Trump's actions and, like others, going to have to wait and see and evaluate what this means and what this could look like. But the state is still very much behind the industry and pushing it forward, despite what the federal government might have planned.
This is poised to be a real economic driver for New Bedford. We've been hearing that for a while. Is that outlook just also in a pause and wait and see mode, or is it just keep charging ahead? Do you have a sense?
Yes, so I mean, for example, vessels are still moving offshore for the Vineyard Wind project. There's still the major turbine components at the port, and so Vineyard Wind, for example, is planning to move ahead. But South Coast Wind, for example, is a project that has plans to use the port for staging construction, but also long term operations. As does another project, an Avangrid project, plans to also use New Bedford for operations and even maybe establish a manufacturing facility there for these cranes. But that's all contingent on these projects moving forward. So if they don't move forward, you know, that manufacturing facility might not settle in New Bedford and the jobs might not be there as well. And at minimum, they're probably going to be delayed and things will slow down. So yeah, again, it's a wait and see what's going to happen, but it could have impacts just here in New Bedford too.
And we should mention that fishermen, fishing groups are expressing some gratitude and relief here. That's Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Anastasia, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good one.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current, CAI's Gilda Geist, and Anastasia Lennon there of the New Bedford Light. Thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. Dylan Thomas almost had it right. Around here we say, do not go gentle into that Friday mid-morning. Listen, listen. The news roundup is always informing. That's all we've got in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.